podcast thing.
The stress is on now.
Hello and welcome to the Hackaday podcast. I'm Elliot Williams.
And I'm Tom Nardi.
This is episode 339. It's the vape episode, but we've also got a flying DeLorean and DIY science. This week in Hackaday News, tons of SuperCon announcements. On Tuesday, we announced the workshops and their tickets went on sale too. As we go to press, there are still a few of them left for a few of the categories. So if you're coming and are interested in those workshops, you can still sign up, maybe, at least. I'll lay our cards on the table. We're recording this on Wednesday night, and we announced it yesterday on Tuesday. There are still some tickets left.
Workshops go notoriously fast. I think that's the kind of the one, a complaint might be a strong word, but the one feedback we often get is that, like, I wanted to do a workshop, and it was instantaneously sold out. I was mildly surprised that even when we went to record this, there were still spaces available. So, you know, we're not joking. If you're interested, don't waste any time and sign up.
If you're getting your SuperCon hype on, now is the time. SuperCon hype. All right. Well, I'm hyped.
When the leaves change color, it's time to get hyped for SuperCon.
This is true.
This is a journey into sound.
Let's go.
What's that sound?
Well, without further ado, let's run a What's That Sound?
Oh, boy.
Doodaloo. This is a brand new sound week, so here comes the sound for you to guess at. And, Tom, you can take a crack, too, if I uploaded it.
Yeah, I grab it. Oh, okay. I want to say, it's been gone for quite a while, doesn't it?
I think I put two samples together.
Okay, yeah, it switched like halfway through. I want to say like, but I fear that might be too obvious.
It is too obvious. Congratulations.
Yeah. Damn it. It's been a while. This might be the metric that's too easy if I got it. That's the barometer for how well it will go with the public.
I've been doing so many like pop culture-y things lately. I had to do something mechanical. And it's just what I came up with on the quick and dirty. Well, if you listeners out there know what the sound is, then head on over to hackaday.com/podcast. Scroll on down to What's That Sound. Click on the form, fill it out with your handle and your guess, and we'll see who got it right next week. Someone among them will get a Hackaday Podcast t-shirt. Congratulations, Tom Nardi.
I know. It's been a long time. I don't know. I don't want to say I've never gotten it, but I feel like I've never gotten it. I certainly can't remember getting it before, but I want to believe that it happened.
I want to believe. I'm rooting for you. Well, then let's head on off to the hacks. I wanted to start off this week with a hack by recurring microcontroller hacker Aaron Christoffel. This is when low SRAM keeps the doom off your vape. Last week we saw a vape hack. This week we saw a vape hack. It's going in the air. They're different vapes though, so don't be fooled. The Pixo Aspire is a vape that has a 323 by 173 pixel touchscreen on it, among other things. It's got a rocking microcontroller, 16 megs of SPI flash. This is the vape that has everything. It even has a Bluetooth low energy chip that it isn't even using. Why? I don't know. They must have been like, we'll figure out some way to use Bluetooth on this vape. Anyway, none of this stops our hero, Aaron, from opening it up and taking a look. It's actually really cool. If you go to his GitHub page, he has the front board, which is just like, yeah, tons of microchips covered in Kapton tape. You flip it over and there are a million labeled test points. It's like the easiest hacking target you've ever seen. The debug lines are labeled for you. The SPI lines for the screen are labeled for you. It's beautiful. It's like a dev kit. It's like they meant for him to do this. And so, of course, he wanted to run Doom on it. The problem is he didn't quite have enough memory to load all of Doom onto it. There's a video of him playing Doom on it. What's going on here? The answer is he's written code to use this thing as a USB remote display. It basically takes in images and displays them on its little screen, and he's written software on his computer that then sends these images across. So you can use this vape as a second monitor. So it looks like he's playing Doom on the vape with a mouse. He's actually playing it on his laptop and just viewing it on the vape as an external screen.
Oh, the world we live in. I can just imagine somebody like at the coffee shop and have on the computer and have their vape set up as a secondary monitor, right?
I really need another monitor. I don't have enough monitor space. Oh, here, you can use my vape. I've flashed some extra firmware onto it so that you can display 6 FPS videos.
I suppose it was only a matter of time, right? I mean, we've seen these things get increasingly complex. And I know we've certainly covered other projects where people have been, you know, started with just stripping them for batteries, which is already such a crime, you know, that they have these disposable vapes with LiPo batteries in them and people are just throwing them in the streets. You know, I am not a vape guy. I don't think you are either, Elliot.
I am not.
I can only assume there's some, like... I don't even know how to describe it. There must be some subculture of the vaping scene that, like, compares the capabilities of their vape, right? Like, I guess I think everything has that, right? If you get car people and they, like, they tweak their cars and they race them, I guess you have vape people who, you know, want to have the most advanced vape at the coffee shop. I don't know. But, I mean, they must be doing this for a reason, right? I mean, they're putting this hardware in there and bringing the price up, too, because, you know, if at least, I don't know if you said, it's like $35 or something for this thing, which doesn't seem cheap to me.
Right?
It seems pretty expensive for a vape. They're definitely passing the cost to the consumer, and presumably they're happy to pay it. So there must be some street cred involved in being like, oh, yeah, I have the BLE-enabled vape. I can't, I can't even wrap my mind around it, but it's happening. This must be what it feels like to get old, I guess.
I wonder if they have videos loaded onto it or if it's just to like display ads. Like I can imagine, you know, puffing and being like, you know, I need to watch, you know, puff watch a TikTok. Like there's got to be some weird world in which a tiny little screen like this is useful
that you also put in your mouth, so impossible to actually see while being used, but I guess everybody around you can see it, so that's what counts.
My secret fear is that what it actually is there for is to display whatever vape juice you're using, right? And it's probably its actual reason for existing is just to say you've got lemony lemon loaded right now or whatever, and not, you know, purpley purple. These are not real vape flavors.
You say that, but I'm not as confident as you are that they're not.
Don't run out if you're wanting to buy purpley purple.
Yeah, how can they say I can get purpley purple?
Yeah, but I think you nailed it here, is that the reason this one is so ridiculously well endowed is that A, it's not a disposable vape, B, it's a high-end one that costs $30, and C, well, there is no C. But like, why would you put a Bluetooth chip in there if you're not even using it yet? I don't know. It's future compatibility.
I mean, as much as I hate to say it, I could imagine a future where like your vape pops up a notification on your phone to tell you that you're low on.
Oh, you're almost out of juice.
You know, like I'm not defending that like in any way, but I can certainly see it, you know, as something that they could tout as a feature.
I totally defend that. I think that's awesome. That's a great feature. I'm down with that. And last week in vaping news, I guess.
Oh boy. This is how far we've fallen.
I guess Christina covered it really quickly. It was hosting a website on a disposable vape. If you missed it, this one's fantastic. Bogdan the Geek took apart a much cheaper, much less well-endowed, but strangely enough, the same brand of microcontroller. These are the Puya brand micros, which are insanely cheap little ARM CPUs. The Puya in the disposable was an M0, Cortex M0. not much memory, certainly not as much outboard flash, etc., etc. But that didn't stop Bogdan. And what I really loved about this is that he was hosting a web server on this. So that means, you know, you need an IP stack. He uses micro IP. You need some way to get the data out, and the serial line wasn't cutting it. So he uses semi-hosting, which is an ARM debugging mode. It's just basically like a serial memory dumper debugging tool. It's like printf as a system call, basically. And so you can just put a debug point in your program and it just spits all of the memory content out. And he's like, hey, wait, I can use this to transmit data. So he's using the semi-hosting to send serial data into and out of the chip in this disposable vape and encoding it over SLIP serial line IP, which is pretty damn cool. Anyway, it's just really funny, that one, because, I mean, a web server, ironically, these days, a web server is not all that resource intensive, and you can run it on even a disposable vape. But the clever bits in Bogdan's hack are the way he abuses the debugging mode to get serial data in and out. I thought that was really sweet.
Yeah, a thought occurred to me kind of while you were talking, and I was reading the rest of this post. You know, it closes with saying that Aaron recently did a hacked firmware for an Anker charging station.
Yeah.
That had, for whatever reason, its own ridiculously overpowered microcontroller. And, you know, I wonder, are we just hitting the point now where, like, there is no such thing, really, as a underpowered microcontroller? Like, you know,
yes.
Have even the cheap ones become so powerful that, like, well, I guess I'll just have, you know, quad-core USB power bank because that's the cheapest microcontroller available anyway.
Yes, that is absolutely the case. And this is living proof of it. This is, you know, the vapocalypse is absolute proof that we are in a world now where it doesn't make sense to use a small microcontroller, certainly for anything, you know, that you're making in quantity like these,
yeah.
Because these things are so cheap, you know?
Yeah, like, what are you going to do? You're going to get, you know, an 8-bit micro in 2025, you know, if you can even find anybody still making them in large quantities, and then struggle with, you know, all the downsides of that.
They're ironically more expensive.
Yeah, like, yeah.
It's cheaper to get one of these, like, you know, super high production, ultra cheap micros that nonetheless has really, you know, what 10 years ago were really high end features.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was doing, you know, the CyberDeck SAO, you know, and I was looking for the microcontroller. In my mind, I was going to do, you know, AT Tiny. And then I looked on DigiKey, and an AT Tiny was more money than a modern microcontroller with far more capability. So even at a scale of, I think I made 30 of those, like, I'd literally be wasting money, you know, to use an 8-bit micro compared to a 32-bit. So, I guess this is just that at scale of, you know, tens of thousands or even more.
Yeah,
I suppose, mean, you know, the ultimate winner is us, right? Because we're going to be finding these things on the side of the road. We'll be able to repurpose them. But it is just wild to see what, like, the bottom of the barrel looks like now. When the bottom of the barrel is playing Doom, you're in for a good time.
That's right.
Well, I picked this one first because I've been personally very interested to see this project develop. We've covered it for at least a couple years now, and every time there's an update, I get very excited. This is Brian Brocken's full-scale flying DeLorean. And before you get too excited, I should qualify that it is a foam DeLorean, but hey, it's better than no full-scale flying DeLorean. The story starts, I think, in 2023 or so, where Brian got his hands on this robotic arm CNC router deal that could, you know, the sort of thing you'd see working on a car in an assembly line. And he had the bright idea, like, well, I'll just have it carve a DeLorean out of foam, because, you know, that's what you do when you have access to this kind of technology. And that was cool enough, right? A styrofoam DeLorean to have kicking around the garage. And then at some point he said, well, now I'll mate that with effectively a gigantic quadcopter frame and I'll have a flying DeLorean. And I don't think anybody would say building a flying DeLorean would be easy. You know, despite what it might have sounded like, you know, I'll just, you know, tack this on another. But it's proven to be fairly tricky, as this multi-year project has shown. This latest update, we finally get to see the thing fly, which is really cool. I don't think there was ever a question that it would fly. It was just making it happen and making it look, you know, scale appropriate. I mean, there's drones that are picking up way heavier things than foam block cars, right? So, I mean, the parts were out there, and it was just kind of a matter of putting it all together and tuning it. And I know there was some trickiness. The frame, again, this is a real, it's a one-to-one scale DeLorean. So, like, the frame had to be that big. And I know it was tricky to get a frame that big that was still stiff and lightweight enough. He had tried aluminum, which has since been swapped out for carbon fiber. You know, getting a quadcopter that's, I don't know how long this thing's got to be, but like at least like 15 foot long probably, you know, that takes some tuning. I think the cool feature, other than seeing the thing fly, is that he's also implemented the tilt down wheels now, because if you're going to have a flying DeLorean, obviously the wheels have to tilt down like in the movie. And I don't know if I even realized this was the goal, but it actually drives too on the wheels. I thought, you know, silly me, it's enough to just have a flying DeLorean, but no, he wants it to actually drive on the wheels. So the rear wheels have a motor, and the front wheels do turn, albeit a little roughly. So the thing can actually drive on the ground as a gigantic remote-controlled car, and then lift up and fold the wheels in. It's really remarkable to see. I don't know, you know, what it will take to make it look like a real DeLorean, because it still looks like a big block of foam. I do wonder about, like, you know, the finish. You imagine there's going to have to be a lot of weight added for even just the paint and the, you know, there's still no doors, there's no hood, there's no... So I don't know how close he'll get to it looking like a real car and still flying, but it's already incredibly impressive. And one of those projects where you're happy for him, but you're definitely jealous. And wish you had access to the same gear they do, you know?
Well, I think what's wild about this is just the kind of scope of the ambition. Like you said, it drives on these wheels and then they pivot up, like, you know, to turn down like their hover motors, like it did in the movie, which means he has to make this crazy mechanism that both allows the wheels to turn and pivot up like this. And that's a bizarro and neat bit of engineering just all by itself, never mind, you know, making a car size hovercopter frame and then all the foam skin around it and all that. What's really wild is that, of course, it's got a bit of weight to it, so it has to have some pretty beefy propellers, and he has to manage to fit these, like, he's got this weird constraint because the propellers have to fit inside the body of the car. So like, he can't have them be arbitrarily big. They have to fit inside the car so that, you know, you can't see them, right? And so it's funny because they're offset a little bit. It's got four of them, like a quadcopter, but you have to imagine the front two are kind of skewed off of each other and the back two are, just because there's not enough width inside the frame to have them both there. Otherwise, the blades would collide with each other as they go by. You know, I could see how this takes like 4 years to get this far, because getting this far has involved surmounting a whole bunch of crazy problems. This is a deep one, folks.
Far be it for me to question the guy building the Flying DeLorean, right? Because he's much farther along than I am. But, you know, speaking like you're saying with the offset motors in the front, you know, I wonder, would one large motor in the front, you know, not have made more sense? Like a tricopter kind of setup, I would have thought, you know, and that would have given you the ability to have one larger prop.
But tricopters fly funny. Tricopters to get... Now we're going to get deep into the quadcopter weeds, but tricopters have to have one of the motors on a pivot, because otherwise they can't yaw.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They can pitch and roll, but they can't yaw.
And the single motor's usually in the back too, right? I don't know if I've seen one lead with the pitch motor.
But tricopters ended up being, you know, in the evolution of funny flying vehicles, tricopters ended up being abandoned because you have to put one of the motors on a servo, and or at least you have to be able to pivot the motor with a servo, and that just sucks.
Yeah, I also wonder, you know, how well does the Flying DeLorean have to fly to be impressive? You know, like I'm
cool not any better than this one.
Right. Like I'm just cool with it hovering. Like if I'm it hovers done. And you have vague control, like I'm not expecting this thing to, you know, doing loops and rolls. Like it doesn't need to be like the FPV drone of DeLorean.
That's right.
You know? Just go up, go left, right a little bit, come down, you know? So I think there is probably
dude, it drives on its own wheels. Right. And then it takes up and then the wheels fold over. What the hell do you want?
Yeah, you're so far beyond, the competition. I think you can relax a little bit. So, I don't know. I mean, if I was him, I would not be too worried about maneuverability in the air. I think you've already won just by having the thing take off. But, like we said, there's not... I guess you could cut some weight if he needs to, but it's hard to imagine where he could shave the weight off at this point. It literally is a styrofoam block. I guess you could make it thinner in some places. And I am interested... I guess the hood, like you said, can never be solid. Maybe it could be some kind of a mesh that's pulled over tight to kind of look less weird than a louver.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, it'll have to flow a lot of air, though.
Yeah, right. Anything you do is good. But you also need protection for the whirling death that's under there, too. So I don't think you can realistically leave it open.
You can't skip too much on that, can you? Yeah.
Well, we're several years into this. I'm invested now. So however long it takes, I'm still here and I'm ready for it because it is one of the most impressive things I've seen in a long time. And yeah.
Yeah.
What else can you say? It's Flying DeLorean.
Well, my next hack is a proof of concept hack by Nick Build. This is heart rate measurement via Wi-Fi, the DIY way. We wrote up this paper coming from a bunch of researchers at University of California, Santa Cruz a few weeks ago, heart rate monitoring via Wi-Fi, where they propose using basically the Wi-Fi channel state information packets. That is the kind of lowest level, how is my Wi-Fi doing status information. You put the person in between a Wi-Fi sender and receiver. You read the channel state information passing through them and use that to detect their pulse. And Nick has, just a couple weeks later, implemented this. And it's really cool. I just love seeing people be like, oh, academic paper? Yeah, let me just recreate that in my bedroom. And this one's particularly easy, though, because it really does just require two microcontrollers that can do Wi-Fi. In this case, he's using two ESP32s and just recording the channel state information packets and sending them to his computer for further analysis. Oh, but going from the channel state to your heartbeat being detected isn't entirely easy. In between, there's a neural network, and that's kind of cool here. He's using a long short-term memory network, LSTM. It's a recurrent neural network, so it's designed around taking samples over time, and it takes its last prediction and feeds that in to the next prediction it makes. So every time it gets a new data set, for instance, in this case, it's new channel state information. It takes this channel state information and what its guess at whether you had a heartbeat going on last period was, and it puts these all together. And so that makes it have kind of a long memory in that sense. The previous results get weighted into the current result, and that's where the memory comes from. And that lets it do this kind of pattern recognition that it needs to do, where it says, oh, the signal's perturbed for a little bit and then not perturbed, and then perturbed for a little bit and then not perturbed. And that is the person's heartbeat going on. To train the model, he's also got a standard pulse detector hooked up to it. And so he's feeding his computer like a continuous stream of these channel state information packets and a continuous read on his own pulse. And he just sets the neural network on it and says, okay, go learn the pattern. And it does. And it does pretty darn well. It's usually within, a few BPM of the baseline heartbeat. Now, I don't think he's done the really hard tests on it, which is to go run around and get your heartbeat way, way, way up and then test and see if it can do that. I don't think he trained it on that kind of data either. So it's kind of not fair to make it extrapolate like that. I'm sure he could, but that's not the point here. This is a proof of concept and it's awesome that he gets it working at all. And it's a super neat example of how neural networks have kind of become LLMs in people's minds these days. This isn't one of those. It's a kind of a few years older model, and it's a model that's really successful at doing things other than just predict the next word and make random babble. This one's really good at doing pattern recognition, basically. Patterns over time in particular. And for that, they're super, super effective. A bunch of people in the comments point out, you know, you could have probably done some statistical analysis on this and gotten, you know, gotten as good results. And that's probably true. But as he points out, it would have been a lot harder. Instead, he's just like, okay, model, here's my input data, here's my output data, go learn it. And it learns the relationship between them and picks up his heartbeat from that. And what other things it could measure. I mean, you could do things presumably other than just heartbeats. Anything you can put in between the radio transmitter and receiver, you can do some sort of weird, I don't know what this is, radio spectroscopy on it. Really, really cool project. It made me think about trying to expand this in other directions, and also just how useful some of the more traditional neural networks are when you have a well-defined problem and you actually just want to solve it.
Well, like you, I really appreciate this. I don't even know what I'd call it, like guerrilla engineering, where like,
yeah,
you see something that's in a paper and it's, you know, it's locked up and you're like, all right, well, I guess I know what I'm doing this weekend. Let me, just for spite, let me reverse engineer this whole thing and release it as open source. I love that. And you know, what other kind of community does that sort of thing happen? You know, Nick, we've covered his stuff for a long time and he is exceptionally prolific. But as far as I know, he wasn't like previously interested in this. It just kind of popped up and he was like, all right, well, I guess I know what I have to do for like the good of mankind right now. And I really appreciate that. As for the tech itself, you know, it reminded me a lot of something that we had covered several years ago, where they were trying to use smart speakers to do a similar thing, get pulse data. And the idea was that, you know, if you had like a nursing home or something, you would have a smart speaker in there and you could kind of passively monitor the occupant of the room without freaking them out, you know, because you don't have to, like, you know, hold grandma down and check her pulse. You could just kind of pick it up from the, in their case, they were using ultrasound. Same, you know, kind of application potentially, where you could have someone being monitored without them knowing, which is creepy in its own, you know, it could definitely be looked at as a creepy thing, but there's certainly valid applications for that medically, right? If you can kind of get it. Actually, I wrote that up. I'll put it in the show notes. It had kind of the same limitations that we're seeing with this, is where you kind of have to have the thing facing your chest and be sitting there. In the case of the ultrasound, it was bouncing off your chest and seeing the actual deflections. In this case, you know, your heart or, you know, diaphragm, whatever, is between the sender and everything. So that's kind of a hurdle. But, you know, it's still a step in the right direction. And I mean, even if you had to say, okay, sit in this chair and there's going to be a non-contact pulse measurement, or, you know, that's not bad, right, compared to traditional methods. So it's certainly a step in the right direction, and remarkable what can be done even with, you know, low-cost hardware. I think that one of the cool things is that it is relatively so cheap to get involved, right? Like, this is basic stuff. There's not a whole lot of medical monitoring, I think, that you could get into without breaking the bank, right? So this is a very interesting and fertile area for DIY experimentation, because you don't have to have a expensive hardware to get started.
Yeah, and I think your idea of, you know, think about the uses for this. Imagine you go into the doctor's and, like, you just sit down in the chair and you're talking to the doctor, and by the time you're done, it's got your pulse recorded and, you know, something else has picked up your blood pressure and something, right? It's like the tricorder scenario. It's like non-invasive medical sort of thing. Like, it just makes that experience less, you know, less annoying for both the doctor and the patient. Nick's video and our write-up both said that the paper is behind a paywall. Of course it is, but nature always finds a way. Someone has linked to the original author's website, and so you can just download the PDF there if you want to. It's up on their website. None of this is secret. I agree with Nick that the paper, you know, it doesn't hold your hand and tell you exactly how to do it, but it does give you enough that you could certainly replicate their work. And well, I mean, Nick could. Now that he's got his code published for it, now you can for sure, without even batting a brain cell.
Well, my next pick, low cost, high gain, a smart electronic eyepiece for capturing the cosmos. Say that three times fast. Another one that I picked, kind of, I have some experience with this. You know, every few years, I convince myself I want to get a telescope, and I'm sure I'll get some comments about this. But the experience of using a telescope for me is not quite what I imagine it to be, you know, and that's my own fault, right? You really have to have some dedication. You have to sit out there in the dark and you have to know what you're doing. And I just want to be like, oh, look, there's Saturn. I want to see the rings. You know, I want it to be very quick and very easy. I'm not particularly patient and I'm probably going to want to look at my phone. So forget about like night vision and my eyes being adapted. And when you come at it with that kind of approach, you're going to have a bad time. A friend of mine bought a very nice telescope and we just were not patient enough to get the kind of performance out of it that it was capable of, because you just have to have a certain amount of fortitude. But you can solve a lot of that problem if you just take your own eyes out of the equation. The idea here is to, you know, take that telescope that, you know, maybe he's been sitting in the closet because you couldn't figure out how to properly use it, and you put a camera in its place, and specifically a camera that has some good low light performance, and you wrap it all up into a device that can kind of do the hard part for you. So instead of you looking through an eyepiece and trying to squint at some smudge that might be a nebula, the camera can, you know, do a long exposure kind of thing and pipe that right out to a laptop or your smartphone hooked up to it. And you just look at it on the screen. And, you know, I guess there's a little bit of the, you know, the romance of the telescope is lost, right? You know, you're not exactly how they did it back in the day. You know, this is not what Galileo was seeing when he was looking through the telescope, because you're looking one step removed. You're looking at a digital touched up representation of what the scope sees. But I think that for just the instant gratification of it, and like I said, I've been frustrated trying to use a telescope, and you can imagine how like a kid would be. But with this, you know, you can just point the scope at the sky and you look at a little screen and you're not, it's not fake. You know, you are seeing what the scope is seeing. You're just seeing the best case scenario version of it. And I think that has a lot of benefit to get people excited. You know, if you can show them that, like, this is what the scope is seeing, and this is, you know, that nebula or that planet or whatever, I think it would be a much preferential than staring through it and not seeing what you wanted to see and just having a bad experience. So for me, I think a project like this is, you know, while maybe some would say outside of the spirit of using a telescope, I'm all for bringing, you know, some high tech gadgetry to the game if it means you walk away having seen something and felt like, you know, you were actually exploring the cosmos rather than just squinting and getting frustrated.
Boo to you. I think optical astronomy is awesome. I also think that sensor astronomy is awesome. Like, all the science astronomy done these days is done with cameras and sensors and remotely. And basically the poor astronomer sitting there looking at a computer screen like you are all day. Like, how cool is that? That's not cool. It's significantly cooler to go out and peek through a telescope. But that's not what this is about. This is about making an awesome, extremely light sensitive sensor that, you know, you can get really deep shots with. You know, he gets some really good shots out of it. So, you know, and the thing costs $200 instead of $2,000. So, you know, I think that speaks for itself, right? You know, I'm with you. That's hella awesome. I'm totally not with you. Half the fun of astronomy is like freezing your ass off, squinting at smudgy dots.
Well, I should say, like, in this case, the device does actually have an eyepiece on it, and there's a tiny little screen in there. So you can hold your, you know, if you want to pretend, you can hold your eye up to it and look through it, but you're still seeing the digital representation, which I think that's cool, though. I mean, you know, at least you're huddled over the scope and, you know, you're twiddling with it like like you're really doing something, but you're seeing, you know, this perfect virtualized image. But this is the sort of thing that can get people more excited about astronomy and just, you know, the skies in general, and that's always good. I think however you do it, we could probably both agree that far few people are looking up anymore, right? So whatever it takes to get you, you know, your eyes skyward and seeing all the stuff that's out there, I think that's just a net positive.
My next hack is a really neat article in IEEE Spectrum by Allison Marsh. How a failed video format spawned a new kind of microscope. And this new kind of microscope was, I mean, historically new in the 1980s, but it was brand new to me today in 2025. So I'm stoked I read this one. This is the story of RCA's video disc, which I guess went on sale as Selectavision, and kind of they started developing this brand new technology in the 60s. It ended up being really hard to commercialize. And so they kind of announced it in 1972. And then they were announced it again in 1977. It was really going to come out this summer. And finally, it did come out in 1981. And by then, the VHS tape had gained popularity and kind of eaten their lunch. So as a rent videos using this medium, Selectavision VideoDisc was a total flop. But the way this disc worked, it wasn't a laser disc, which is probably what you're thinking. And laser discs are, of course, you know, basically like CDs or DVDs or Blu-rays. You bounce a light off of a mirror, and if it reflects, it's a one, and if it doesn't, it's a zero. This instead uses capacitance. You know, so it's got a layer of metal that's either closer to or further away from the disc's surface, and it spins real fast, and it detects the capacitance difference as it spins around. Engineers at RCA had a patent on this, which is really cool, and then tried to kind of commercialize it in this disc. When that failed, they turned to NIST and said, hey, can you guys tell us how good this is? Like, we think we can get really small capacitances on really tiny distance scales using this. And the NIST folks did and were like, oh yeah, you really can. And what happened is this turned into then the scanning capacitance microscope, because they are able to detect, you know, capacitance differences on the scale of attofarads, which is 10 to the minus 18 farads. It's like way, way, way below picofarads. That is not much capacitance with an incredibly high spatial resolution. And so this ended up finding its use in microchip manufacturing as a way to scan inside the chip for defects. And so it's really cool. It's a total failure. Like, they tried to make it into a, you know, a retail video product, and it wasn't that. But then they're like, hey, this is like really useful for IC fabrication diagnostics. So there you go. I think that's just a neat story of how, you know, smart engineers working on a problem took a physical property and were like, hey, we can use this to store video data. But then, you know, even if that part didn't work out, it was like, hey, we had a really cool measurement of a physical phenomenon. So boom, scanning capacitance microscope makes chip fault detection easier. The world's a better place. Straight line like that.
Yeah, you know? That's how it works. I think you had mentioned that, like, Laserdisc. I also at first thought this was the same thing, and I guess it talks about in the linked article from Spectrum. I guess like a lot of people make that confusion. Like, no, it's not Laserdisc. It's a video disc. It's something totally different. There was obviously a lot of downsides with the technology itself. Like, they talked about, like, you couldn't touch the discs because that would screw it up, and like dust would be disastrous. So like the discs had to stay in these plastic sleeves, and like the whole plastic sleeve had to be loaded into the machine. It seemed like there were some warnings that this might not have been the most practical of video format. But hey, like you said, even failed technology does occasionally move the needle forward, and it is interesting to imagine a future that we were watching movies on. I thought it was interesting that, I guess, if you're coming from like vinyl records, right, this is sort of the natural next step in the evolution, because it did say, you know, they had the little stylus that would go across it,
right?
It was measuring capacitance rather than just the grooves like you would on a record. And I suppose without the leap forward of lasers, okay, this sort of makes sense. You took what we were already doing and just improved upon it.
Maybe my head is too high in the clouds here, but let me hear me out on this one. So first of all, you know, in that kind of 1960s, there was scanning electron microscopes where you shoot an electron at it and you see what bounces back off. But then around about this time, maybe a little before, maybe a little after, we have all of these weird commercial audio and video products, including but not limited to the vinyl record, which you just mentioned, which uses a tiny little needle to go into this gap and it detects the wiggles as it goes around this gap. Atomic force microscope is a device that uses a tiny, tiny little needle and pokes down at such resolution that you can pick up individual atoms as you drag it across the surface of something. It's basically a record player. This one has got this weird video disc with a capacitance reader, and that gives you the scanning capacitance microscope. There are, of course, scanning laser microscopes, which are basically just CD players where shoot laser at the surface and see what reflects out. Is there a microscope type for every medium we have? And I'm like,
oh wow.
Yeah. And so the missing one is the scanning magnetic microscope that would be like audio tape, right? It would be like videotapes, like VHS, like scanning magnetic strength. And I think the answer is that's just not an interesting physical quantity. Yeah, I think it just is a dead end. Sorry.
Almost made it though.
We almost got it. But I'm telling you, the record player is just a big clunky atomic force microscope.
I like that. There's certainly something there. There's something there about, you know, building upon those first principles, right? And just getting more and more accurate with it.
Exactly. All right, well, take us home. You have to avenge my failed analogy.
Well, this one is actually something I wrote up last week, and I'm going to invoke privilege and talk about it because I thought it was fascinating. This is listening for the next wow signal with low-cost SDR. I think what makes this project unique is that it comes from the University of Puerto Rico at Arecibo. Arecibo was synonymous with their radio telescope until it was sadly lost. And these are people who are very into scanning the sky for radio signals. And, you know, who better to take on this challenge? The story kind of goes that the university was doing some research on the WOW signal, which was detected back in 77. They kind of realized that, you know, because of how primitive the gear was back then, that you could pick up similar signal with off-the-shelf SDR, software-defined radio. That we now have for, you know, in the parts bin. So that kind of started this WOW at Home project that they've been working on, where they want the community to take, you know, your RTL SDR, hook it up to a parabolic dish, of which there are actually a couple on the market now. You don't even have to figure out how to make your own. There's a couple turnkey dishes that you can use. There's a couple of amplifiers and filters and the sort of thing you'd expect, and then hook that up to the Raspberry Pi, which ultimately would be running their software. That is kind of the hole in this thing right now. Everything kind of exists except that the software isn't quite there. But once complete, the idea is that these telescopes, spread hopefully all over the world and in the backyards of willing participants, could cover the sky and look for a similar signal to the WOW signal, which should be said that they do not believe is the product of an alien civilization or anything. They think it's some kind of very rare astrophysical event that may happen again if we have enough ears to the sky. Personally, I've been fascinated with the idea of the at-home radio telescope, and it's another one of these things that, you know, has not become, I mean, you could have done it back in the day, but it's so much easier and so cheaper to do now that, I mean, it's almost like a weekend project to get this set up. And it's kind of crazy to think that, you know, the technology required to pick up the WOW signal in 77 is now something you could do on a rainy Saturday. You can put this thing together. It's simplified by the fact that they're not even proposing like motorizing the dishes or anything. Their whole concept is just, incidentally, it was kind of how the Arecibo telescope worked itself, because it was, you know, a crater and not easily pointed. you know, you just look at one point in the sky and let the rotation of the Earth do the work for you, right? So it's a very, as easy, and you know, I use that term lightly, as easy as the homebrew radio telescope has become, this is even like a step easier than that, because you don't even have to worry about pointing the thing accurately. Once you got it in position, it just sits there. So what's missing is the software. They have some software, but definitely the tricky part is, how do you parse this data coming out of the receiver and figure out if it's worth something and acting on it? So that's where they're kind of looking for help. Anyone who has experience with radio signals and software development, specifically, it sounds like the goal is to do it in Python and again, make it deployable on a Raspberry Pi, right? So those are kind of your constraints. They do want to have a mode, which I think is just sounds cool, where it'll do a live preview of the data in like the paper printout style of the original WOW signal that was detected by Ohio State, that famous picture, which is on the article of, they circled it. Oh, wow. So they would have a live little screen going. And I'd love to have that just ticking away on a screen in my office or something. So if you're into this kind of a project, like I said, they're looking for help from anybody who's interested. And I think, the loss of the Arecibo telescope was huge to astronomy. And this will not replace it by any stretch of the imagination. But I think it is cool to see a community project kind of in that spirit and at least honoring the idea of the Arecibo telescope and bringing that home, literally, right, in a way that the original scope certainly could not.
It's funny that we live in a world where it is easier and cheaper to operate a radio telescope in your backyard than it is to operate a regular old light telescope.
Yes, yeah, accurate.
Very but accurate. Like, all you have to do to make a radio reflector is you get a nice, properly parabolically shaped piece of metal or metal wire, even. Like, it doesn't even have to be solid. It's pretty easy to do compared to like grinding all the optics you need for a fancy light telescope. It's a lot easier. And they estimate that, you can set yourself up for $500, including the computer, if you buy stuff off the shelf, and you can do it for a lot less than that if you're willing to build some stuff. And I know we've seen some foam board radio telescope designs where it's not even a real parabola. It's just kind of a horn-shaped thing that points up at the sky. And what used to be the limiting factor in these, of course, is the SDR you have in the middle of it. And now that you can pick up an SDR for $10, $30, if you want to get a really good one, for this sort of frequency range, it's fantastic. So like radio astronomy is well within range now. And I think that's interesting too. At the same time, we are seeing lots of weirder stuff out there in the radio and X-ray frequencies that this could actually be useful for. Like, you don't have to be looking for little green men signatures. There are, nobody really understands the fast radio bursters, which go off every once in a while. And actually, just this year, there was a new and similar sudden burst of light. What was this one called? Long period radio transients, just in May 2025, was kind of classified. The astronomy here gets a little out of reach of the home gamer. Like, to do real work on fast radio bursters, you need to detect the polarization of the signal coming in. And I think you can't do that with simple gear. Somebody's going to build the amateur rig that can do polarization detection too. And then, then the game's on again. Still, you can kind of see these things. And they've been elusive and only recently discovered because there are super short transients out there. And so this idea of just getting a whole bunch of people to point dishes, even little amateur-sized dishes, all up at the sky, makes it a lot more likely that we'll see these really short events. If thousands of people have these in their backyards pointing up, that provides a lot more coverage. And I think that's kind of the science goal of what they're aiming at here. And I think that's really, really cool. If you've wanted to get into radio astronomy, there's never been a better time than now. And this is kind of making it super, super accessible. Okay, quick hacks. I'm going to start off with Olivia Hoy Young Park's dodecahedron speaker is biblically accurate. This is a fantastic project to make a super fancy looking speaker on the cheap, but it's also a workshop that she's giving with undergrad students where she teaches them to do CAD and 3D print things and come out with this design on their own. She actually runs them through an anechoic chamber, and they work out pretty well too in terms of how they sound. But I think this is just a great, like, beginning to end few session workshop project that ends up teaching people how to do 3D modeling and then build the thing and then solder it together and then end up with a speaker in their hand. Really cool. Skolkami 3000 robot balances ball on plate. This is another kind of educational project. This one, he's got a resistive touch sensor on a plate, and then it's supported by three servo motors that help it balance a rolling steel ball on the top. This is a really common project to learn, like, how PID loops work and how reverse kinematics and robotics work and stuff like that. What I really loved about this one was the way he was choosing to wiggle the platform around, which is using a 3RRS joint mechanism. So you got two joints that spin, revolute, and you've got one that's a ball end joint, and that's spherical. That's your RRS, revolute, spherical. If you know what those Delta picker robots look like, this is just exactly that, but kind of turned upside down to hold the plate that moves the ball around. So he gets to do all the fun reverse kinematics for this, and then the PID control and the sensing and the filtering. And that's just a superb project from beginning to end. And I think it's a real learner. And last up, November Co. This device is a real page turner. This is a simple project. It's a microcontroller, an endless encoder, some 3D printed case, and some code. But it makes a device that lets you scroll through the pages on a Kindle or a similar e-reader with this, you know, just really nice, intuitive, roll your thumb across as if you were flipping pages gesture. I just love how much of a cool interaction it gets from how little of all the stuff that's around us. You probably do it with a vape. The vape is overqualified, actually.
You can read the ebook on the vape. Forget about turning the pages.
Oh, you do an ebook on the vape. That's what that screen is for.
Yeah, one sentence at a time.
Make your 153 pixels work for their money.
Kids are smoking more at the vapes, but at least they're reading too, you know, I guess.
scroll.
My first quick hack is calculator battery mod lets you go the distance, and I feel like this is something that a lot of us have probably run into. You have some kind of gadget that takes alkaline batteries, and you say, oh, wouldn't it be great if I could put a rechargeable lithium cell in there? And it often turns out to be a lot more complicated than you think. In this case, MagmaBow actually came up with a very clever little PCB that sort of bridges the original contacts in the battery compartment for this Casio FX-CG50 calculator. There's just enough room in there for one of these little LiPo pouch cells. It all comes together really clean. The back closes up, and still more complicated than I'd like to see to add rechargeable batteries to an existing device. But it's definitely inspiration that if you're willing to do it, it's certainly possible, and you can have a very professional end result. Next up, for a robot claw, the eyes have it. This is kind of an interesting twofer here. Goku X wanted to make a 3D printed robotic gripper claw kind of deal for purposes unknown and unspecified. That's a cool enough project in itself, and it looks like it's got a nice wide grasp and relatively simple mechanics if you want to make your own. But the really cool thing is that right at the center point of the gripper, they put a OV3660 camera module, which combined with the ESP32 gives you like a video downlink of what the gripper is seeing from its own perspective. And it's just kind of a really unique robotic tool. And if, you know, if you're in the position where you're grabbing something with one of these things on a robot or whatever, you know, having that, you know, first person view, for lack of a better word, could be very helpful. And it's kind of surprising that we don't see more of this. And finally, Mandrill Magic, small box assembly with 3D printing. This is a really cool one. You know, we often think of, you know, rightfully so, as 3D printed parts as kind of the final product, right? You print the thing, you take it off the bed, you install it. That's the beauty of printing parts. But this is a case where the printed part is actually tooling, essentially, in the assembly line. James Bowman has thousands of flat boxes that need to be unflattened so that the devices can be put inside of them. And, you know, that only takes a couple seconds to do, but when it's thousands of them, that time really adds up. So he went into OpenSCAD and he designed this really cool wedgy kind of curved shape that he could clamp to his desk, and basically you could just take the flat box, push it down to this shape, and it automatically unfolds the box and it gets it square so it can be closed up in one quick motion. Just a cool example of how, you know, 3D printing is not just limited to, you know, little gears and widgets and brackets, and then it has all kinds of applications if you have the right tools and you look at it with the right kind of eyes.
That brings us to our Can't Miss articles. These are long-form pieces written by our fantastic Hackaday writing staff. This week I wanted to pick Maya Posh's Meta's Ray-Ban Display Glasses and the New Glass Holes. This is fresh on the heels of Meta, formerly Facebook's, not very slick reveal of their new smart glasses. What's nice is she doesn't focus on the kind of technological flubs that went on during their release, but instead tries to say, what's the technology here? Why did this not work when Google Glass tried to do it? What's different now? And what exactly is going to be the killer app for something like this? And that's the part that I think is really an interesting and open question. I think with the Google Glass also failed product, you know, we all figured out what the downsides were. It was complete invasion of privacy to have an always-on recording video recorder on your face, and basically they were too expensive for what they offered and all of that. And I think the question Maya's raising here is, has the software's capability gotten up to a point now where you could actually do something useful with these things? And it's interesting, they use a wrist-mounted sensor and kind of interface pad to let you steer around on them, so you don't have to put your finger up to the side of your head and zoom back and forth and stuff. There was no real interactivity with the Google Glass, and adding the armband adds a bit of interactivity to whatever is going on there. It's still always got to be tethered to your cell phone. It doesn't have any smarts in it on its, well, I mean, it's smart glasses, but it's not doing all the computation. It doesn't have the network connection, etc., in the glasses. That would just be too silly. They would be even chunkier than they already are. So I don't know. She comes up with simultaneous translation or something as a possible solution. But I think the delay in doing any AI translation now would make that awkward. I mean, is it better than you just don't know the language and you have to look it up in your like Frommer's guidebook to figure out how to say, I would like a 3-minute egg? I mean, yeah, it's probably better than that. So, you know, that's a good thing. But is it better than doing it on your cell phone already? And that, I don't know. Like, why don't you just take a picture with your cell phone and cut out the smart glasses middleman? I mean, I guess it could be always running, but then your phone's going to be always sending all the text out to the internet. I don't know. I just haven't figured out what the compelling use case is for these yet either, honestly. I mean, I think that one could work if everything were a lot faster. That's the way the tech's going to go, of course. Like, the mainframes in the background doing the number crunching are not going to get slower. The routines doing the character recognition and translation aren't going to get any slower. So that's, you know, maybe that's the viable future. You could have cool overlays over it. I was talking to Jerry Ellsworth at SuperCon ages ago when she was working on her AR product. And she said that she thought the first commercial use of AR that's going to be mainstream was in like instruction manuals. You know, now you plug this into here and now you do this into here. How cool would it be if you had like a real-time overlay of the parts showing you, you know, this one goes into that one or whatever, or, you know, just stepping you through a complicated installation procedure with an AR glasses overlay. Maybe something like that would be a cool killer app for it. I don't know. We asked people to sound off for killer apps in the comments. we got kind of predictably a lot of cynicism about whether this is going to be a good thing or bad thing for society. I honestly think our commenters weren't even cynical enough. Nay, I'll pitch it to you before I get too cynical. What do you think could be a killer app that would make it worth spending $600-800 on a pair of glasses that displays images to you and has a camera in them?
Well, I mean, I think you were saying the augmented reality kind of instructional thing is very valid. I don't know about for the individual, but I mean, that was specifically what NASA wanted to test with the Microsoft, the HoloLens. They sent a couple of them up to the space station. And the idea was that, you know, the astronauts could put these things on and they could be visually walked through, you know, complicated repairs, or even just, you know, a lot of the time the astronauts are doing stuff on experiments that, you know, they don't know anything about. Not to say that, like, obviously an astronaut's a very smart individual, but, like, you know, some company sends up an experiment and it needs to be manipulated in such a way, and they've never seen it necessarily before, and they just have to kind of follow along with the instructions from the ground, right? Like, that's actually what a lot of the work on the ISS is. It's just, okay, open this box, push this button, turn this knob, what does it say on the screen? And they report back, you know? So having something like this right in their field of view that would show them exactly what is expected would be helpful. The average person does not necessarily have that kind of job, right? So you could see, you could imagine something like that maybe for medical use. I could see that, like telemedicine, or even just a reference, right? Like, you know, you're doing surgery and you could have some kind of reference materials right in your field of view, hands-free. You know, I think a lot of it, though, is going to be that sort of thing, right? Like, you need, if you're going to spend this kind of money, you need to have, I think, a professional application for it, you know, frankly. I don't know that there is a recreational, in other words, kind of thing. I mean, certainly the idea of being able to take a video or picture of what I'm seeing at any moment is interesting. I think anyone who has kids knows, like, the advantage. Like, there's been so many times where, like, I wish I could have took a picture of that, because, you know, the one time this month that she smiled.
Right.
You know, like, there's things that happen in real life that you'd love to be able to capture, right? And you don't always have your phone out. But to what you were saying, that would mean a constant recording, and then, you know, okay, save the last 10 seconds or whatever of the constant stream, which, you know, is possible, certainly, but would have a serious knock on, you know, battery usage and that kind of thing. So I don't know how practical it is to run a recording all day. You know, as it is, actually, like, the Google, at least on the Pixel phones, like, when you take a picture, it's actually, as long as the camera app is open, it's effectively recording. And when you hit the shutter button, it's, like, actually the half second before you hit something like that, as long as the app is open. And that does help you get those, like, you know, blinking and missed it kind of moments. So it's a little bit like that, but on a larger scale. I would say, though, you know, regardless of the immediate applications, I mean, this stuff is coming. You know, wearables, it's the sort of thing that the applications will probably follow the device, right? Like, they're going to get cheap enough, and I'm not saying this is necessarily cheap enough, but they're going to get cheap enough that people are like, all right, I'll buy the damn thing. And then I think you'll start to see more inventive uses of it. You know, it used to be, if you wanted a 3D printer, you had to spend some decent money and work at it. So you probably had an idea in mind, right? You knew you wanted to make stuff, or you wanted whatever, you wanted to repair parts. And now 3D printers are almost at a point where they're like a mainstream commodity. And I know, I personally know at least two people who have bought 3D printers without any clear goal in mind. They got the printer because, oh, it's, you know, it's $199 or whatever on Amazon. And then they just went on Thingiverse and just started printing stuff out. And then through that, like, they eventually said, oh, wow, I can make my own stuff. And then they designed their own parts, right? So I think, to a degree, it's once you hit that mass market price, people will start buying them, and then you'll have, you know, the collective brain trust of all those users. They'll find more applications for it.
I mean, if you think about other successful wearables, the smartwatch is probably the obvious one. And what do people do with their smartwatch? You know, they get a text message, they're able to read it on the watch and maybe do a limited reply to it instead of pulling out their phone and doing that. So it's kind of like a smaller phone screen replacement. Would the glasses fit that same niche? Is it useful to have them fill that same niche? I mean, maybe it may be that the user feedback is so important that that the glasses will fall down on that. Maybe they'll have some retina tracking thing, though.
Mm.
You know, some eye tracking thing where you can be like, look over here to click, I'll be home 10 minutes late, hun. You know, look over here to say, I'm on my way. You know, something like that, right? I could see that happening and maybe being useful. But that niche is kind of already filled by the smartwatch. It may be something with the camera. And, you know, I can imagine me 20 years ago saying, why do I want a camera on my phone? I already have a camera. You know, this is a phone. That's just stupid. And now our phones have become cameras. And like, we barely even call each other on them. Now it's just like a little portable computer screen. So maybe that's the direction it's going to go. I don't know for sure. Here's my super cynical take, though. I do know why Meta wants us to wear these things.
Oh, yeah.
And that's because they've got some really big AIs that they want to train. And they want to train them on human behaviors in the physical world. And nothing would make them happier than to get a 24/7 video feed of you doing everything you do in your everyday life for them to feed into their machines. People say this sometimes about Tesla, that one of their, you know, big secret advantages is all the data they collect, and it lets them, you know, iterate faster on their self-driving algorithms and stuff, because they just have tremendous amounts of video information of human drivers doing their thing. This is like that, but for everything else you do all day, you know, for cooking pasta in the kitchen. And if they can classify that and then use this to, I don't know what Meta's overarching plans are, you know, whether this is going to be cooking pasta in the metaverse. Oh, sick burn. Or it's going to be training AI for robots to cook your pasta for you, which actually I think is pretty reasonable as a guess for why they want to collect all this data. So, yeah, I mean, that's my conspiracy theory hat, ladies and gentlemen. I put the aluminum hat on so you don't have to. But my guess is that whether you want this or not, Meta really wants you to want this. And they have a supreme vested interest in filming everything you do all day, all night. Yeah, check the EULA on these glasses and tell me I'm wrong.
Well, and that kind of begs the question, if that is the end goal, and I don't doubt it at all, you know, how long before we start seeing these things kind of subsidized like we do with smart TVs, right? Like, smart TVs wouldn't be nearly as popular if it wasn't the fact that they were, you know, $200 for a 50-inch TV, you know, but they're cheap because the people who want your viewing data are, you know, kicking in to bring that cost down. So are we going to start seeing, you know, $99 wearable smart glasses because Meta is picking up half the bill, you know, or whoever? And that could be what gets them out there, right? If you just bring, like I was saying, you know, if you get that price low enough, you'll get impulse buyers. And then, you know, maybe it will be a pasta timer, you know, for $99. All right, sure. A thing that, you know, watches me make pasta and tells you when it's done. That might make more sense at $99 than it does at, you know, $600, right?
If Meta doesn't do that, somebody else will.
Yeah.
My guess it'll be someone else with a much more serious robotics bent, because I think that's the obvious application of all this video data. But I could be wrong. It could be, you know, other video classification things. It could be, you know, just other human behavior stuff. Who knows?
You know, when I first saw this article come up, and I before I read it, obviously, I thought it would touch more on what I think is kind of the fascinating evolution of this technology is that... You know, for better or for worse, Google Glass definitely informed the rest of the industry on what not to do. And
right?
Mine doesn't, I guess, really touch on it in here necessarily. And maybe there's even room for another article, right? These modern smart glasses look as far away from Google Glass as you possibly could. Like, Google Glass definitely looked like something a creepy nerd would wear. You know, like, for better or for worse, it just had that look. It looked like no normal person will ever wear this, right?
Do you think she picked that picture on purpose? Because I don't know this guy here, but
he looks like somebody you should be worried
creepy,
about.
He looks like a creepy gooner is what he looks like.
Like, I mean,
he is giving me this is a horrible person. I don't want this person even smirking at me the way he's smirking at me vibes. Like, if you haven't read the article, go look at it.
Yeah, and please don't sue us if you're that guy.
in stark contrast, there's like Mark Zuckerberg, who just looks like a big freaking dork in his giant oversized black frames. And that may be the trick. I'm picking up what you're putting down. I think that's less evil than the freaking scary tech gooner.
Yeah, like the Google Glass definitely looked like something a crazy person would wear in like a Bond movie or something. Like it looks like a villain's prop.
Yeah.
Because it's so weird. It's not glasses. It's a thing that's, I mean, you had to wear the fake glasses just to wear it because it had no, you know, I mean, it was only one side. It was like, it's not asymmetrical.
This is what the Borg wears.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes. It looks exactly like a Borg piece of equipment. It looks like an alien abducted you and forced this onto your head. Whereas, you know, these new ones are just, like you said, they're clunky glasses, but that's not out of style, right? Clunky glasses are kind of a thing, right? So, like, I think 99% of people would way willing to wear these than a Borg implant, right? But, like, but going beyond that, like, I know from when the Google Glass came out, they also, you know, the Google Glass was the whole thing, right? Like, there's actually... I remember, I think it's the same hardware as like the, what at the time was like the Google Nexus or whatever, their last year's Nexus phone. It used the same hardware. Like, so the whole thing is in there. Like, they were trying to do it untethered in comparison to the new ones, which, like you said, are a tethered device, right? Like, so everything they did with Google Glass, the new ones are getting away from. They're going to be tethered devices. They're not going to be standalone. They're going to look way less menacing. And so for better or for worse, like, I think Google, you know, they fell so that, you know, Meta can crawl, right? Because they definitely learned what not to do. And I suppose there's value in that, getting all the bad mistakes out early on.
I take a step back and I think about society and I think about privacy and I think about all of these things. And from that perspective, they're hella creepy. And they're... I don't need people recording everything 24/7. And I don't think society needs that. And I don't think that's going to end up well. I've seen Black Mirror episodes like this, people. Like, it doesn't end well. Everybody ends up dead. So, you know, I don't... And I think in the real world, everybody's just going to end up suing each other. But I'm fine with that, too. As long as, you know, some mayhem gets caused. I'm going to say it. I'm against it. I'm fully agin it. Use them in the privacy of your own home.
My pick for a can't-miss article this week is Lewin Day's How Regulations Are Trying to Keep Home Battery Installs Safe. And this is not any kind of, you know, hit piece on Tesla Powerwall or anything. It's really just talking about how, you know, we have this new generation of devices, really, where you want to put massive lithium batteries in your house. And there are some downsides to that because they are, you know, a little explodey if treated improperly. You know, at the scale of your smartphone or whatever, it's fairly manageable. But when these things are, you know, as big as a refrigerator and in your garage and your car might run into them, there's certain rules that need to be in place. And it does kind of complicate things and make it more expensive. But I think it's hard to argue that there needs to be, you know, some regulation on these kind of things. And as much as we like to do things seat of the pants here at Hackaday, there are occasionally projects that you might need to get adult help with. I'm kind of have a personal connection to this right now. My father got solar power at his house. He, you know, he's no futurist by any stretch of the imagination. He didn't even have a computer or a smartphone, but he just wanted the lowest energy bill possible. And so, in view of raising prices from the electric company, he got these panels set up. And the first time that the power went out and my mother was in the dark, she was like, why do we not have, you know, we have solar panels on the roof, but we don't have any kind of backup facility. And he's like, well, I didn't pay for that. I just paid for solar panels on the roof to spin the meter backwards effectively. So then, you know, they've recently been looking into, you know, doing batteries or something like that. And he got a quote for, I think, 3 Powerwall units installed, and it was like $40,000.
Yikes.
Like, far, like way, way more than the solar setup itself costs, right? It, like, insanely expensive. And, you know, when they broke it down, part of it is because you have to have all these kind of provisions, and there's a lot of hoops to jump through, and you can't just sit, you know, a 3,000 kilowatt hour battery on the front lawn, right? Like, there has to be... And Lewin gets into some of these specifically, and of course it's going to be different wherever you are in the world. There's different laws everywhere, but you know, he talks about having, you know, if it's going to be outside, there needs to be like concrete anchored steel balusters around it, so like a car can't hit it. You know, all kinds of stuff that just makes it more complicated, and of course more expensive, right? Like all that adds up. That kind of stuff is, you know, low tech, right? Like putting in a concrete supported beam, but it's labor and it's parts, and it makes everything more expensive. So you think like, okay, I know what a lithium cell will cost and I can just throw them together, but there's a lot more to take into account. And I think that is going to be kind of a problem because it is so expensive. And, you know, again, to take my parents' example, they're now leaning far, far, far towards just getting a natural gas Generac, you know, that's like plumbed in and will start up automatically, because that would be like $12,000 or something for the same capacity. And okay, it's not off grid, and it's not as green as solar power, but I mean, come on, you know, that's a serious price difference, right? And that technology is well understood, and you can just kind of like throw one of those in the backyard with minimum hassle. So I don't know what the answer is, because I think, you know, like Lewin kind of points out, like you need there to be rules to protect people who might not understand the danger of this kind of thing in their own home. Like for example, I didn't even realize this until reading what Lewin was saying. Like, it is strongly, strongly recommended to not have these things in the house if at all possible. You know what I mean? Like, they really want it to be, in fact, he says in the U.S., it has to be either like in a garage or at the absolute minimum, like on an exterior wall, you know, like it can't be like in the middle of your house. Like, you can't have it in the middle of your house in the basement. Like, no, like that's just, it's too much of a risk if they catch fire or something. You know, they say like regulations are often written in blood, right? So this, if you didn't have that as a rule, somebody would put a big bank of batteries in the middle of the dead center in the middle of the house in the basement. And, you know, you wouldn't be able to get water on it in the event of a fire. So I think it's a necessary evil, but I think it is unfortunate that it will hold this technology back, because it does make it more expensive and more complicated, to the point that, you know, I don't think it's not practical for a lot of people. Let's say you don't have a garage to put these things in, right? Like, so you're already limited right there where you can even put them in your own house. So necessary, but it kind of undercuts the promise, I think, of this technology for a lot of users.
Yeah, I totally agree. And a lot of people come up with this in the comments too. They're like, you know, it's just so much easier to ship the electricity back out the wires that I've already got in my house and let someone else handle it, because, you know, it's just too much hassle. You know, if what you want is emergency resilience like that, maybe a gas generator is the way to go, because, you know, like you said, tried and true technology, hella cheap. It's just kicking around. You know, you have to change the gas every once in a while to keep it from going bad. But like, that's it. That's all the maintenance. We kind of understand the flammability risk of storing gasoline. You know, it's not so bad. Lewin points out one of the other problems with batteries, which is that, you know, it can't be near your house because you don't want to catch the house part of your house on fire. But then, like you said, it has to be accessible to the fire department if something does go wrong. And it can't be anywhere where they get too hot or too cold. And like, so Lewin's in Australia, and there you're worried about the sun baking your garage and the batteries in it and causing them to overheat, which, even if it doesn't cause a catastrophe, makes them run a lot less efficiently. And or if you're in a place where there's winter, you know, and your garage gets cold, God forbid, like, good luck charging those things when they're really cold. Lithium doesn't like to take charge when it's really cold. Like, there's all sorts of kind of issues and constraints on where you should locate the batteries and how you should put them. And like, the safety features, I'm afraid, are kind of at odds with the battery efficiency features. Like, ideally, it would be in your living room where it's 20 degrees all the time. But there's a couple reasons I don't want to have the fiery thing in my living room. I'm a lot more cavalier about lithium batteries than probably I should be. I've had a lot of good experiences with them and zero bad experiences. So, you know, I'm not one of those people who's afraid of batteries catching on fire. But I do, you know, I do accept that if you're going to install hundreds of thousands of these, millions of these across America, you're going to get some bad cases, right? Like, you're going to get the worst case in a few of those, even if it's 100,000 to 1 odds. Like, I'm personally not worried about it. But if you're making rules for the whole country, that's too many houses burning down. Well, that wraps it up for this week's Hackaday podcast. Thanks very much for listening. To follow the links, head on over to hackaday.com/podcast. And if you see anything cool or do anything cool, drop us a line, tips@hackaday.com. And until next week,
keep on hacking.
Sure.
We sound like geniuses in the final podcast. Bunch of tools in the raw cut, but geniuses. Makes chip. Blah, 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 blah. All right, well, that brings us to our can't miss hacks.
Well, my good, and of course I messed up as soon as I said we got to do it quick.